Many years ago, when we were just starting out on this venture, Sonny Osborne would visit so often on Saturdays that we started a tradition that we called Saturdays with Sonny. We're going to bring that back today, and next week we're going to have a two-part visit with Sonny. The occasion was the passing of Merle Haggard, and I thought, well, that'd be a good time to get Sonny on the air again and let you all listen to his memories and whatever else comes up in the conversation about those times. Sonny's a fascinating guy, and I'm happy to say a friend of mine. First part, we broke it into two parts. First part of our reprise of Saturdays with Sonny, occasioned by the passing of Merle Haggard. So coming up next, I'm going to let Sonny Osborne himself talk a little bit from the stage about the trouble with banjo players and banjos. Then we're going to get right into our visit with Sonny today on Unreal Bluegrass. This will be a throwback to Saturdays with Sonny, which we did so many times. I always ask you, it's free, on demand. Go back to unrealbluegrass.com and you can listen to every conversation that's ever been broadcast with Sonny Osborne on this program. I guarantee you're going to enjoy it. The archives there are full of almost 230 different interviews. Sonny's probably 20 of them, and I'm not stretching the truth. This is Sonny talking about the trouble with banjos. That'll lead right into our first visit with Sonny. The occasion was, again, the passing of Merle Haggard, but we cover a lot of territory, as we always do. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass.
Banjos don't like anything. Did you all know that? They don't. You ever notice the banjo player is the most courageous human being on the face of this earth? And then just look what it does to you. It tears you apart. Look at Alan Shelton standing over there. Alan is a great example of what the banjo. Look at Scruggs.
I don't know nothing.
Banjos are the boy. I was telling you, they don't like people. They don't like air, wood, sound system, microphones, nothing. They don't like anything. And every now and then, all during one show, sometime, what if you can hear it, it'll go, "I'm going out of tune now. Goodbye." And then those like little Roy Lewis never tune, so it don't bother him. So. Hopefully he'll stay over there and bother people till we're through. Anyhow.
I'm real happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass, Sonny Osborne. Sonny, it's been a while since we've done this. We started out early in the history, if you want to call it, of this show. We did almost an every other week of Saturdays, and it seems like it might be a good time to, you and I keep in touch, but it might be a good time for us and for you to talk a little bit about, specifically Merle Haggard more recently, and plus I always just want to chat with you, so I'm welcome back again, my friend.
Yeah. Well, it's good to be here, and, the show's moving on along, I hear.
It is.
So everything's getting along pretty well. I'm doing okay, and I hope you are. Everybody listen, I hope they are, too.
I think they are. It's moving. People are listening. People are paying attention, and they'll always love it when you're on. I can tell you that the feedback that I get when Sonny's on is just remarkable, you know, and I know you don't care about being flattered, but that's the truth. But I thought, well, heck, we would talk a minute about Merle Haggard, who just passed away on his birthday. And then I know you had a long relationship with him. So,
well, I think it started, the year that we won the CMA vocal group, which was 71. We started working with Merle right after we won that award, as a matter of fact. And we opened for him, for 4 years after that. And financially, it wasn't very good business on our part, I didn't think. But on the other hand, we got to play bluegrass music to probably 500,000 people, maybe.
Wow.
Maybe more than that in that time, because we were working to anywhere from 10, 15, 18,000 people a night with him. And it was a good experience. It was good to watch how Merle did things. And it was good to put bluegrass music in front of that many people. And they never would have heard it before or after.
Yeah.
And so that part of it worked out pretty good. We worked Harrah's in Lake Tahoe with him for 2 weeks, I think it was. And that was quite an experience. The way they do things is so much different. Everything is right to the second. I mean, when we went on, like at Harrow's in Lake Tahoe, when we were going every night, we did 20 minutes before, and then Merle came on after that. And when they introduced us, there was a clock right down in front of us that started like on 20 and then it went backward. And they told us that when it gets to zeros, you're off. And if you are not done, the lights go off and the lights go off. But you're done when it gets to zeros. And he explained it. He said, I can't remember the exact figures, but he said, for every minute you run over, the club loses so many $1,000s. It was remarkable, the amount of money. But they had it figured out right to the penny on how much they would lose if you ran over. And as I remember, the closest thing to country that they've had in the big room there now, I need to explain that. There are two places that you play is out in the, where the machines are and where the people are out there gambling and all that. But then they have a big concert room, and that's where we played. And the closest thing they've ever had to country music was, it seemed like I want to think Eddie Arnold and like a 27-piece orchestra.
Oh, geez, yeah.
And I mean, Merle broke every record. I mean, people just absolutely, you couldn't get them in. There's so many, I mean, just unreal. And that was a really great experience to see how they ran things. And, about that third or fourth night we were on, this guy, the manager of that place, came up and he said, we would like to hire you guys to work in the casino. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, if it pays enough, that's good. And he said, oh, it will pay plenty. He said, and I said, well, how much do you have to work? He said, you have to do 45 minute shows a night.
Holy cow.
And I said, no, no, we don't want to do that. And that guy said, you don't? I said, no, that's too much. And I don't want to do that, because here's the way I look at that. Bobby, probably the greatest singer for what he does that ever lived. I mean, ever. And he brought it every night. I mean, he just really did. And so I figured, okay, if we do 45 minutes four times a night, that's double what we usually did. And so that would mean that the number of dates that we worked a year would have been double. And I wasn't really sure that Bobby's voice or mine or my mentality or his or whatever could hold up like that.
Yeah.
And so I turned it down. I said, no, we don't really want to do that. And so anyway, I mean, we played in cities like Fort Worth, Los Angeles, San Francisco. We worked the Coliseum in San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, Salt Lake City, Minneapolis, and we played Madison Square Garden in New York. And we would never, I mean, bluegrass music would never get in those venues.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, and then on top of that, we had a great sound man. We called him Captain Feedback.
Captain Feedback.
Captain Feedback. He was a real nice man. And he was so good. And he just had a feel for that. Like Frank Neat with the banjo.
Oh, yeah.
He just had a feel for doing sound. And he was Merle's sound man. He traveled wherever Merle traveled. And it was really a good experience. We got to meet Bob Wild because of that. And
most people don't remember that Merle played with Bob Wills.
Yeah. I don't know, did he?
I thought that he...
He played... I think he played Bob Wills in his mind. Merle did. He loved Bob.
Okay.
Bob Wills is a nice guy. He's all right. Anyway, contrary to what everybody says. On March the 18th of 73, we played Dallas, and we knew this about maybe 3 or 4 days beforehand. Our agent called me and he said, they're asking for Merle to be at the White House and they want you guys too. And so I said, well, who wanted us? And he said, remember that guy named Haldeman?
Yes. H.R. Haldeman.
One of the instigators of
Watergate. Yeah, he's famous for lots of reasons.
Yeah, and he's the one that requested us, and then Pat Nixon also requested us.
Oh, okay, all right.
And as well as she wanted Hager, too. And I never had flown. I mean, I had no reason to and didn't want to, and I couldn't see any reason that I would need to. And so our agent called me, and I just turned it down. I said, no, I don't think I want to do it. It involves flying, and I just don't want to fly. And he said, okay. And then in just like an hour and a half or 2 hours, he called me back, and he said, you really need to do this. And I said, no, I don't think I do. And he said, well, think of the guys that's with you, and this will be the only time in their life they'll ever get the opportunity to actually play inside the White House and meet the President Nixon and hang out there in the White House and eat and all that stuff. And I said, well, yeah, I guess we could do it. And so there's a guy in Fort Worth at WBAP Radio, and his name is Bill Mack. And he had a radio show. We were on that show the night that we flew from Dallas to Washington. And he was talking to me about it. Some of the guys had told him I never had flown before. So he was talking about that. And I said, well, I'm really apprehensive about doing it. I don't really want to at all. But I said, I've come to kind of talked into it. He said, okay, well, and all that stuff. So on the way from Fort Worth to our motel in Dallas that night, we had the radio turned on, and he played a request for me. And he said, here's a song that I want to play for Sonny. And he said, it's his first time to fly tomorrow, and they're going to the White House and play for the President and all that stuff. And you know what he played? He played Patsy Cline's I Fall to Pieces.
Oh, jeez.
That's nuts. And Bill Mack is a nice, a really good guy. And it was a fine disc jockey. And he had an all-night show. And it was on WBAP, and which was a 50,000-watt station. And they just boomed north. I mean, just really. And so...
Especially at nighttime, those things went everywhere back in those days.
Yeah, and so we flew to Washington, and it was nerve-wracking, but of all people, Earl Scruggs, either call me or send a message to me one way or the other. I talked to him the night before, and he said, are you nervous? What? Yeah, Earl, I'm nervous. And he said, well, you know, there's no feeling of detachment. And he said, it's just like sitting in the chair in your living room and you don't feel like, and I got to thinking about that, and that one thing helped me a great deal, because when you fly, there is no feeling of detachment. Mm-hmm. You're just sitting there in a chair. And it's not like you're floating around in the air, you know, which you really are. And so that helped me a great deal. And so we went to D.C. and got that out of the way and played for Nixon. And about, let's see, 2 or 3 weeks later after that is when Watergate just really broke out in earnest.
Okay.
And he was a nervous man.
Yes, he was. So,
and I really enjoyed playing at the White House and for the president and his wife and Eisenhower's son, David. Is that his name?
Yeah.
David Eisenhower was
David.
There. Mm-hmm. We got to go through the White House, and you know that thing goes down in the ground 7 stories.
Well, they told you 7. It probably goes down 20.
Well, yeah. Well, we went down in there too.
That's where they keep the spaceship from 20. I've heard about the bowling alley. Yeah.
They got bowling alleys. They got movie theaters, tennis sports. That place is remarkable. And it's a shame that everybody doesn't get to see it. But, I mean, they don't, and that's all I said. And we saw the president's living quarters upstairs, and I think we saw everything but one room. And his daughter, one of his daughters, was sick, and she was in that room. And we saw the Lincoln bedroom, and funny thing, after we got through playing, there were some interesting things happened there too. We were standing in this aisle, and Nixon was on the stage. It was in the East Room, I think, it was where it was. And so he was on this little stage up there playing. And I'll tell you, it's a room to where they have press conferences. And so he was up there to mic, and that's where we were going to work. Well, we were standing back there on the aisle. And when he introduced us, we were in a hurry to get up there to the stage, and there was a CBS television cameraman, and he was sitting, but he had his right foot out in that aisleway. And as I went by, we were wearing these big old Western roper boots, and I stepped right on that guy's ankle. And I know it broke. I know I broke his ankle. Oh, it's unreal. And Haggard's guys stood in the back of the room where we could look at them. and they just laughed at us and pointed at us and all that stuff and just really trying to mess with our heads, which they did. I mean, that's nervous to play.
Yeah, I guess so.
And what's that German scientist that came here?
The rocket scientist?
Yeah.
Wernher von Braun?
Yeah, that sounds like him.
Yeah.
He was there.
Oh, wow.
And all members of Congress, all in their tuxedos and all that stuff. These women, probably every one of them got $35,000 or $40,000 worth of diamonds on. Or maybe more than that. And so here we are from Thousands, Kentucky, playing for the president.
I know.
Oh my gosh!
When you said you toured for, I guess you opened for like four years. When you toured for like 4 years, opening for Merle. Well, let me ask you this: was he a bluegrass fan? I mean, or what?
Not really.
Okay,
not really. Merle's just a more than anything else, he's like a music fan.
Okay.
But I don't really know. I'm not sure how we got that. I never did ask anybody. We were so busy right then that it didn't really matter. And that's why we could take that time and learn from that experience. But I wanted to tell you this.
Yeah, sure. Thing.
And we were on this on stage in the White House. And when we got done, and they introduced Merle. And Merle's up there. And right away, he dropped his guitar pick. And he was singing Walking on the Fighting Side of Me. And we were back there where they were we went back there and stood there and made all faces and hand signals and one finger salutes and all that stuff to them. Merle, he was saying, when you're running down my country, man, you're fighting on the walking side. Oh my gosh, we made fun of him for a year with that. Oh man, he's a nice man though, Merle was. He was just a fun guy, and he laughed a lot, and you know, on off times, but he was the greatest, probably the greatest vocalist that this country will ever produce, I think.
Well, one of the things, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Sonny Osborne just in the aftermath of Merle Haggard passing away. That, you know, I think the reaction I've seen, and since social media seems to be everywhere, there seems to be more people reacting to Merle passing, and they always talk about his singing voice as being this more, and you've mentioned it now too, this pure kind of tone and an easy, in other words, it didn't sound like he was straining. They always thought that all the reactions I've seen so far is that he was regarded the same way as you just mentioned, that just like a great vocal. And I don't know how you describe that. I don't know if you can or not.
He could do anything with his voice. And you know what? You mentioned right there, no strain or anything like that. None whatsoever. And I sat every night that we worked with him, I sat about 15 feet in back of him just where the curtain would shield me. And listen to him. And from that distance, you hardly could hear him sing. I mean, it was just so easy. Everything just was so easy. And that's where that sound guy really did his job, because Merle would just be booming out. But you get him back up and you hardly could hear him at all. Mm-hmm. He's a nice man, though. And I got to... I really got to know Roy Nichols, who played guitar with Merle, and he was one of my favorite. He was my favorite guitar player at the time, and when he died, then Josh Williams became my favorite guitar player.
Oh, I got you. Oh, I see what you're saying. He filled that spot for Roy with you as far as being guitar players.
That's exactly right, and he remains best I ever heard, I think. He's something else. Roy became a really good friend, really close friend of mine, and I miss him, and I'll miss Merle too.
Yeah, Ronnie Reno played with the Osmond Brothers and survived that, and also with Merle Haggard.
Oh yeah, he worked with us about. Six or seven years, and then he worked, I think, 9 or 10, maybe more than that, with Merle.
Wow.
And he sang with Merle, and he got to know them really well by being right on the road with them all the time, every day.
Yeah.
Ronnie's a nice man, too.
He's a good guy. He's a really good guy. And just all kinds of talent, and he can fill in all kinds of roles. I figure if he made it with the Osmond Brothers and came out the other end and was able to, you know, still do it with Merle Haggard, then he must have had some.
Well, the work that he did with us, Merle heard it and liked it, and that's why he hired him.
That's what I thought, and I was trying to lead into that, and I didn't want to overstate it, but I thought that's how that happened.
No, that's exactly how it was, and they needed a rhythm guitar player and a harmony singer, and that was what Ronnie was doing. Yeah. And it impressed Merle so much that he just hired him. A lot of people don't like that much when you hire somebody from another band in order to make your band. But I never did look at it that way.
Yeah.
To me, that Ronnie bettered himself by doing that. And I was happy that, you know, he did it. Very happy.
Ronnie posted something through his whoever his publicist is, and, you know, of course, in the mentioning of the fact that Merle Haggard had just died in his connection with him. And he said this to me, and this, I don't know if you saw this or not, but you and I have discussed this. He said that Merle Haggard would often call Ronnie just to hear him laugh, that he loved hearing Ronnie laugh. And anytime you're talking to Ronnie, he's going to start laughing. It was funny to me that he actually made the comment that, you know, Merle would contact him just to get him laughing because he just liked to hear him laugh so much.
Yeah, Merle would do that. And, you know, when you're around somebody a lot, you pick up a lot of their little traits, habits, or things, whatever you want to call it. When Merle would laugh, he would go, as always, too. He'd always do too. And long time after we stopped working with him, I got to thinking that Monroe, when he laughed, he did three. He'd go, I've told people that, and I've had people say, you know what, you're sick.
Maybe.
That might be so, you know. Good sick, though.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, gosh.
Oh, my goodness.